Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, and our board op today, Lizette Tapia. We are looking for a new intern. If you would like to come in and help us out here in the mornings, there's a lot to do, a lot to learn. Please email me at mpkpfk@gmail.com. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
And good morning. You're listening to KBO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next, we have Press Watch. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it is Between the Covers. At 11:30, we have The Film Show. All these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio cordially invites you to the Women of KBOO Celebration and Open House on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. It's here at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us for the open house and an evening of on-air programming hosted by Barbara Bernstein and featuring Carol Major, Victoria Stapiello, and Maureen Key. We're celebrating the contribution of women volunteers, DJs, on-air hosts, staff, and board members in making KBOO what it is today. Light snacks and drinks will be provided. Everyone is welcome. Again, that's the Women of KBOO Celebration and Open House. It's on Friday, June 29th from 7 to 10 p.m. at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Southeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Go with a mic test right now because we're having a hilarious technical difficulty at the moment. But our fierce and efficient engineer Kip is on it, and so I believe that I'm still on the air. And as I was saying, this is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. And it would appear that a bolt that has held steady for the last 30 years has finally given up its last, and so we are switching microphones here. That was it for that bolt. I mean, I guess we got pretty good use out of it. And today, if all the bolts are in, I hope to be talking to Michael Isakoff and David Korn, I hope I'm pronouncing their names correctly, about their new book, Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. And so it would appear that that is still being set up. So let me tell you what the book is about. It is a story of political skullduggery unprecedented in American history, according to The fly page, it weaves together tales of international intrigue, cyber espionage, and superpower rivalry. After U.S.-Russia relations soured as Vladimir Putin moved to reassert Russian strength on the global stage, Moscow trained its best hackers and trolls on U.S. political targets and exploited WikiLeaks to disseminate information that could affect the 2016 campaign. And I believe that the bolts are all in place, and David Korn is now joining us. David Korn, thank you for calling in today.
My pleasure.
Where are you at right now?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
All right. Well, I'm going to read from the Wikipedia. You're an American political journalist, author, and the chief of the Washington Bureau for Mother Jones, has been Washington editor for The Nation, it says, and that's how I remember your name. I remember seeing your name on articles in The Nation. And it says that you've appeared regularly on Fox News. I guess that would be as an op-ed character.
Well, that was some years ago. Some time ago.
Ah.
I'm now an MSNBC commentator.
All right, and you've been on NPR as well, and you've written a book. And so now you can correct my pronunciation. Is it Michael Isakoff?
Isakoff.
Okay, Michael Isakoff and David Korn have written Russian Roulette. And this is one of, well, a few books that are out now about the Trump presidency and its relationship to the Russians. And it's one of those stories that is vast, complex, and yet at the core, it's just, it seems to be a story of personal corruption centering on now President Trump. And before I get into the book, I want to say also that since Trump's capacities are very much in the news today, I would like to invite you also to comment on that, if you please. On who do you think Trump will put in place of Justice Kennedy? I mean, I suppose we're all hoping that it's not Princess Ivanka.
Well, no, he has said it will be someone on a list that he produced during the campaign, but that list includes some very...
All right. You still there? I got a little static going on. This is an interesting morning for technical difficulties. Hello, David Korn. Okay, it's going to be like that. All right, so we will have...
Mike. I'm here at that.
He's still there. Okay.
You can hear me. Okay. All right.
Okay, so we have Michael Isakoff as well?
I'm on.
Okay, thank you for joining us. I think that we have you and not David at the moment. Anyway.
I lost my co-author there.
I seem to be here.
Okay. Now we have...
All right, great.
We have Korn and Isakoff. Isakoff, excuse me. Okay, it's going to be like that, as I said. Well, and so I would like to invite you, I suppose I'll start with David, to put the outline of this story to our listeners. I suppose... through the story of Trump's Russia connections. It's getting a lot of press, but yep. I think you should lay out some of the principal characters and events covered by this book. So please tell me about Trump's history with the Russians and about the Miss Universe pageant and Emin Agalarov and the Steele dossier.
It all depends how much time you have, how many hours. But I'll give you
we have until 10 a.m. Pacific, so we have another 52 minutes.
Okay, I'll give you the short version.
I don't have that much time, just to let you know.
Okay, well, we'll take what we can get.
All right.
You don't have any extra bolts with you.
Okay, Russian Roulette, the book that we put out two, three months ago, Michael and myself, basically tells you the full story of what we know about the Russian attack on the 2016 election. Up till now, this is a very complicated and wide-ranging story with a lot of different tendrils and tangents. And what we've done is produce a comprehensive narrative that gives a reader a full understanding of what goes on in a story that has a lot of different aspects and allows you to sort of process the breaking news of the day. And a lot of people have come up to us since the book has come out and said, well, now we see the big picture. And the big picture is really a couple of decades of Donald Trump wanting to do business in Russia, and then finally in 2013 with the Miss Universe contest, which he co-owned, getting a business opportunity there and deciding at that point in time that he needed to be very, very close to Putin in order to continue doing business. In fact, we
He seems to have wanted to do real estate deals in Moscow.
He certainly did, and that was very much a driving force. When he went over to host the Miss Universe pageant, preside over the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow, he had a business partner there, Aras Agalarov, the oligarch. Trump's real agenda was to forge this business relationship, business deal with Agalarov, a billionaire oligarch close to Putin, to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. And as we report in the book, the plans for that went much further than anybody realized at the time, and even during the campaign. A letter of intent was signed. Donald Trump Jr. was put in charge of the project, and Ivanka Trump even flew over to Moscow in February of 2014 to scout potential sites for the Trump Tower project with Emin Agalarov, the son of Aras Agalarov, the pop singer son. And what happened that disrupted it was Putin's annexation of Crimea and intervention in Ukraine, which triggered sanctions put on by the United States, the Obama administration, and the European Union. One of the sanctioned entities was a Russian majority-owned, government-owned bank that was going to finance the Trump Tower deal. So in some many respects, one can date Trump's hostility to sanctions on Russia, to punishing Putin's government, to those events, which we lay out in the book, in which basically the sanctions screwed his business deal. They torpedoed his hopes of building a Trump Tower in Moscow. And I think that's a very critical point that people need to understand, especially as we come up, as we learn today, on the upcoming Trump-Putin summit in a couple of weeks in Helsinki.
I should interrupt actually again and say Michael Isikoff, American investigative journalist, joining us, and currently the chief investigative correspondent at Yahoo News. Is that correct?
And, that is correct.
And you were the person who would have broken the Monica Lewinsky story if you hadn't been prevented by your editor and so many other
it's
things.
Another story.
Yeah, a whole nother
another
story.
And another book. All right, yeah.
And this this book reveals so much about Trump's character. These connections are so extensive and so detailed in the book, and yet hopefully some people recall that when asked about Russian connections during the campaign and afterwards, Trump would simply blatantly issue a broad denial. He would say that he didn't know Russians, he wasn't doing business with Russia, which is just ridiculous.
That's a key thing to keep in mind, particularly as we head towards this summit with Putin. We describe in the book how through the campaign there were numerous contacts between the Trump campaign with Russians trying to set up back channel communications. Of course, there was an infamous meeting at Trump Tower between senior Trump people and a Russian emissary who they were told would give them dirt on Hillary Clinton as part of a secret Moscow plan to help Trump. And of course, during the campaign, for much of it in the fall of 2015 into early 2016, Trump was involved in yet another secret deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, separate from the one that Michael just described. And so he did not tell voters that while he was claiming that he'd be a president for America first, he was also trying to broker a deal in Russia that could really only go forward with the permission and approval of the Moscow government, meaning he had no interest in criticizing Putin because that would get in the way of the deal. And then we also talk about how later in the campaign, once it became clear publicly that the Russians had attacked the Democrats and had stolen emails and were behind the dumping of these emails, that Trump and his whole campaign kept denying the Russians were involved, even after Trump was told by U.S. intelligence officials that the Russians were involved. So what ends up at the beginning of the campaign, he's hiding a secret deal with Russia. Now, at the end of the campaign, he is actively helping Russia by denying it is attacking the United States. Whether he was colluding directly or not is not really the issue. It's that he was aiding and abetting Russia by clouding the picture and telling the public and telling his supporters that this attack that was underway is not really happening.
And, this
and
is the...
can I just point out that that Trump's denials about Russia's role continues to this day. There was a
to this
really
hour.
Remarkable tweet this morning from President Donald Trump about this, saying, and I'm looking at the tweet as we speak, Russia continues to say they had nothing to do with meddling in our election. Where is the DNC server, and why didn't shady James Comey and the now disgraced FBI agents take and closely examine it? So here we are, you know, more than a year and a half into his presidency, his own Justice Department, his own CIA, his own intelligence community has all uniformly told him that, yes, Russia attacked our election, Russia hacked the DNC, Russia dumped the emails. By the way, even the House Republicans, who have had every interest in trying to discredit the Mueller investigation and protect President Trump, even they have concluded that the Russia did this, the intelligence that behind it was sound, they examined it, and here we have the president on the eve of this summit still denying what everybody else in the U.S. government has said. It's pretty remarkable.
The obfuscator in chief.
I'll go even further. I mean, you can hear the outrage in Mike's voice. I mean, you got to really think about what happened here. It wasn't meddling. This was a Russian attack. The subtitle of our book is The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. You know, the Russians, as we show in the book, had spent years coming up with the strategic plan of attacking not just the United States but other Western nations with information warfare and cyber attacks and disinformation campaigns. So it was an idea they had for a while. They then deployed it in other countries, and then they eventually deployed it in the United States in 2016. And so here you have the President of the United States saying that when Putin says we didn't do anything, I believe him. And does, you know, it's hard not to use words like betrayal in this instance. It's unprecedented. There's never been an American president out there who has said that an enemy that attacked us, well, I agree with the enemy when they say they didn't attack us. And I don't think the American public has fully absorbed, maybe because it's too mind-boggling, this aspect of the scandal.
It is shocking to contemplate, especially when you consider that he is now selecting a second Supreme Court justice, the revealed character through this book. And I do view your book together with The Guardian's Luke Harding's book, Collusion, as something that reveals the character, maybe I should say the lack of character, of the president. This person just doesn't seem to have a moral core. And it brings up the question of just how deeply compromised he is by the Russians. And after reading these two books, I have no doubt that the man is compromised in some way by the Russians. But how deep it goes and what results it will produce, I guess, remain to be seen. Do you have comments on that?
Well, I do think that, you know, we are coming to a critical juncture. I think the assumption among many who are following this closely is that Robert Mueller is going to produce something soon. He's got to do his report on obstruction of justice. He's given the president and his lawyers every opportunity to testify. It appears that they are slow walking this, and at some point Mueller has to sort of either decide he's going to subpoena the president, which could provoke a lengthy court battle in which the next Supreme Court justice could ultimately be a deciding vote, or he's got enough to say what he's going to say in a report to Ron Rosenstein, or to bring charges if he chooses to bring charges. Not clear he can bring charges against the president. So this is likely to be in a report to Ron Rosenstein. And we do know, and one reason to believe that something should be coming soon is there's a common assumption that Mueller will not do anything after Labor Day, for the very reason that James Comey got harshly criticized, deservedly so in the view of many, for how he handled the Hillary Clinton investigation in the closing days. Mueller doesn't want to repeat that mistake. So I think we could be coming to a very critical moment very soon.
It's 9:20 Pacific time, noon 20 on the East Coast. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'm speaking with Michael Isikoff and David Korn, authors of the book Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. And after what was to me a hilarious start as the microphone literally fell into my face, I think we're off and running. And I was talking about the revealed character of the president as this story comes out and is elaborated and verified and detailed. And it's a bizarre story from the start. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask the two of you to comment on the character of Emin Agalarov again, as you say, a singer.
Oh, Emin Agalarov. Well, Trump, you know, had been spent years trying to do business in Moscow and never quite pulling it off. And then in 2013, a Russian pop star named Emin Agalarov, who is the son of Aris Agalarov, the billionaire oligarch that Mike mentioned a few moments ago, who would end up becoming Trump's partner in Miss Universe and then another building project. Well, Emin, in the beginning of 2013, was looking to do a music video, and he wanted someone from Miss Universe, from a contestant. He contacted them and forged a relationship, and then suggested...
Whoops, I think we lost that feed for a moment there.
Did we lose...
am I still with you?
Yes, you are. I think it was just a cell phone thing. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, he suggested holding the Miss Universe contest in Moscow, and Trump leapt at that opportunity. He and his father own a gigantic venue, a big theater out there, and his father is plugged in with Putin and the bureaucracy, and could sort of navigate the business red tape that you have to go through in dealing with ventures in Moscow. And that forged this relationship between Emin and Aris Agalarov and Trump. Trump took to Emin kind of almost as a son. He made music videos with him. They went to some shady nightclubs together, which we go into in the book. But really what Trump was doing was getting into bed with a major oligarch in his family that was connected to Putin, and he was making money through basically a Putin-approved oligarch. And then later on, it would be Emin who would set up the meeting in the Trump Tower between Don Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort, then the campaign manager, and a Russian lawyer who had been sent, they were told, with dirt on Hillary. So this whole this relationship between Trump and the Agalarovs runs through our book. It's odd, it's bizarre, and it explains a little bit of Trump's closeness to Moscow.
And it has to do with the Russian tradition of kompromat. Can you talk about that?
Well, kompromat, I'll talk a little bit about it. Kompromat is something that is long been in the playbook of the KGB, where Vladimir Putin learned the ropes from the get-go, and the FSB as it continued. And sexual kompromat has always been a part of that. Whether that applies in this case, whether there's sexual kompromat on Donald Trump, the evidence is simply not there. If that was a claim made in the Steele dossier. We go through that in some depth and analyze what the sourcing for that was. It's hard to know at this point whether it was anything more than gossip. We do discuss. David made a reference before to a rather raunchy nightclub that Donald Trump and Emin Aguilarov went to in Las Vegas back in June 2013, where acts along the lines of what's in the Steele dossier were performed. We don't know whether they were performed the night Trump was there. My personal theory is there may be some connection and talks about what went on at that nightclub may have been somehow transmogrified into the Steele dossier. But at the end of the day, we simply don't know the answer to that question.
Not yet, I suppose. Well, but certainly a compromise would seem to color the Russian connections with the campaign operative Papadopoulos.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, Papadopoulos.
Well, I'm referring to the fact that
the FBI,
As your book was pointing out, he was brought together with a woman who's described to be beautiful and whose name appeared to be not her name, who was said to be a niece of Putin.
Yeah,
that sounds
Putin's
like an
niece.
Attempt at compromise
Putin's
to me.
Niece. Could well have been. We were talking, David was talking before about Emin Aguilarov. I would point folks to this bizarre video that Emin Aguilarov just put out in the last few days that seems to troll President Trump and has allusions to many of those claims in the Steele dossier. Emin Aguilarov is describing it now as a satire, but it is quite surreal to see a guy so central to this story. And just to make that clear, remember, Emin Aguilarov, the same guy who was with Trump in Las Vegas, who was with Trump in Moscow, who was part of that Trump Tower deal, Trump Tower Moscow deal, was also the guy who triggered the notorious Trump Tower meeting in New York between top Trump campaign officials and a Kremlin-connected lawyer and as part of an entourage that has been so key to the entire Trump investigation. So to have Emin Aguilarov out there engaging in this satire, if that in fact is a very strange development.
Satire is where my mind is going, since he has billed himself as the Russian Elvis, and it certainly puts me in mind of Elvis and Nixon, which brings to mind more characters, not just Papadopoulos, but Carter Page, General Flynn, Paul Manafort, and you introduce these characters in your book as they figure into the story. Would you like to talk about them?
What's amazing is that you talk to people who work on political campaigns from Democratic and Republican backgrounds, presidential campaigns, and you say, how many times, on these campaigns have you had important contacts in high-level contacts with Russians? And these people say, never. This is not how a campaign works. But yet, with the Trump campaign, we have multiple interactions between very senior Trump people and Russian officials or Russian cutouts throughout the whole campaign. Let's just look at Paul Manafort, who happens to be on the cover of our book, Russian Roulette. He was the campaign chairman for Donald Trump and the de facto manager for a good portion of the campaign. And while he's doing this, he is working with a former Russian military intelligence officer who had been his business partner and trying to set up secret communications with Oleg Deripaska, an oligarch, one of the closest oligarchs to Putin. He is on the hook to Deripaska. He had a business deal with him that went bad, and Deripaska is trying to get $16 million or so out of Manafort. And we just learned yesterday in a filing that was unsealed in the Mueller investigation that Manafort and his wife had taken a $10 million loan from a Deripaska company.
So here's the guy running an American presidential campaign. He's trying to, you know, set up a secret communication with a Russian oligarch who's close to Putin, to whom he owes at least $10 million, maybe closer to $26 million. And his form of communication is a former Russian military intelligence officer. I mean, this is like not even a bad Hollywood
movie. Curiouser and curiouser.
And we're told there's nothing to see here. I mean, that just defies credibility.
Well, and I have to add in the headline from The Times in London. Oligarch Oleg Deripaska's former lover vows to pin Donald Trump to Russia. A prostitute now in jail claims she is the missing link in a long chain between the Russian government and the U.S. election and has recordings to prove it. You remember that from March. So that's in the pot, too, and boiling away.
Yeah, we'd like to see those recordings. I mean, you know, if there's anything really there. But, you know, Michael Flynn, his national security advisor during the campaign, and then, you know, in the White House for, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, wherever it was. I mean, he goes over to Russia for a gala celebrating RT, the English language propaganda outlet. He's paid $45,000, and he ends up sitting at a table with Putin. And, you know, Mike had a great encounter with Flynn at the Republican convention when he asked him about that, and Flynn blew his top.
Yeah, I pressed him on who paid him to fly to Moscow to attend the celebratory dinner of a Russian government propaganda station, and he initially said, "Well, it wasn't the Russians, if that's what you're asking." And I sort of followed up, "Well, who paid you then?" And you know, he suggested it was his Speaker's Bureau, which was kind of a nonsensical response, since the Speaker's Bureau is only a pass through for the money that came from the Russian government.
I see. Well, evasions, at least the evasions are consistent. I guess that's not really saying anything good, is it? Well, the book reveals, in the process of all this, the book reveals the irony of October 7th, the three stories that came together on October 7th. And I wonder if I can get you to talk about that, because that day, as you point out, you both point out in the book, is Putin's birthday, was a very confusing day in American politics.
I'll take this one only because I'm going to have to go after this after this answer, and I'll leave it to David for the rest of the interview. But yeah, October 7th was one of the more amazing days in American politics in decades, certainly in my reporting career. It starts out with what the Obama administration had been working on for some weeks, and that is this really unprecedented public statement from the Office of Director of National Intelligence and Homeland Security, saying it was in fact the Russians that had that were interfering in our election, that had hacked political organizations, that this could not have happened without the approval of the highest levels of the Russian government. So basically, the U.S. government was for the first time publicly accusing a foreign power of trying to influence our election. Everybody who was involved in the preparation of that statement thought it was going to be huge headline news that would dominate the news cycle.
Well, certainly.
And then within an hour of the release of that statement, it was almost completely forgotten because a certain videotape suddenly popped, and that was the notorious Access Hollywood tape in which Trump makes all sorts of obscene references to women and what he wants to do with them. That dominates the news cycle, but then shortly after that, there's another bombshell, and that is WikiLeaks starts dumping the Podesta emails from inside the Clinton campaign, emails that the U.S. intelligence community has since concluded had been hacked and stolen by Russian intelligence. So all of that came together in one very bizarre topsy-turvy day. Unfortunately, what the development that was probably the most significant, and that was the first one, the Russian attempt to influence our election, got the least attention from that day.
What an irony. I mean, the information that was so negative that should have destroyed his candidacy was knocked off the top by worse information, by more negative information, and the result was such confusion that it didn't have the effect that it really should have in an educated democracy. How much time do you have, Michael?
Absolutely. I unfortunately, I've got to run now, but I'll leave it to David to do justice to the rest of our book.
Well, Michael Isakoff, thank you so much for joining us on KBOO Portland, the book Russian Roulette, co-authored with David Korn, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. I really appreciate you calling in, and we will continue with David Korn.
Sure enough.
Well, now I want to talk about what this reveals about us. This book showing on that day particularly just how unable the American democracy seemed to be able to deal with the revelations, and still unable to deal with the character of Donald Trump. And I have a theory. I think that it's the same thing that keeps grand juries from indicting cops when they blow away a black kid by shooting them in the back, as most recently happened. Week after week, month after month, we get another story, then we get another grand jury. The grand jury lets the cops off the hooks inexplicably, except that I think that there is an explanation. And I think it's the same explanation for Donald Trump, and that is his brand was whiteness. He was the white candidate. He made that very clear. I could go through a litany of statements and gestures that he made, but I think that would be unnecessary at this point. He is there to retain white power, and I think that white America, the 63 million Americans who voted for him, are very much afraid of losing their power and will, as he has said directly, will forgive him just anything. He could go down to Fifth Avenue and shoot someone. And still, as the champion for white power, he can do no wrong. What do you think of that analysis, David Korn?
Well, I think there are a lot of different things going on. There's certainly, I think, a degree of racism in the support Trump has. But I also think when it comes to why, you know, his aiding and abetting of a Russian attack, and even, you know, the full understanding of the Russian attack has been undercovered by the media, is not prominently driven by a racial component. I think it's that, you know, it in some ways was almost too remarkable to believe, and that this happened in a political season during the campaign, where a lot of reporters were focused more on revelations coming out from leaked emails or the Access Hollywood tape or Hillary Clinton's own email issue, and had a harder time sort of figuring out how to cover this big, larger, overarching matter of a Russian attack on the election. We also had, and we described this in the book, the White House, though they put out a statement on October 7th saying this was happening, was kind of publicly underplaying this attack because they didn't want to give it more attention than they thought it deserved, and help the Russians do their own job by
the no drama Obama treatment.
You know, also they thought they didn't want people questioning the election because of Russian intervention. We talk a lot about that in chapter 14 of the book, my favorite chapter. I think the Obama folks, you know, made some miscalculations in good faith, but still miscalculations. And then we have, you know, our politics these days are so polarized and tribalized that you had Trump out there saying from the very beginning, this is fake news, fake news, fake news. And we end up debating whether it's fake news or not, rather than reporting what happened and the implications of the fact that Russians attacked the election. They did so to help Trump, and Trump won.
But when you say the tribalized, isn't the tribe whiteness?
It is, yes and no. It's partially driven along racial lines, but it's also driven along partisan and ideological lines. Republicans versus Democrats. Not every Democrat is non-white. It's people in rural areas versus more urban, cosmopolitan areas. So it's, you know, it's geographical. I mean, the black-white divide is certainly, I think, part of it, and the brown-white divide. But it's not, I don't think it explains all of it. So, you know, and I don't think that is what is driving some of the media undercoverage of this particular issue. Political reporters during the campaign did not obsess over Clinton's emails and not pay enough attention to the Russian attack because of racism, and because they liked Trump's, you know, racist remarks or were supporting him. That's not why they did it. They did it for other reasons.
But no, I wouldn't accuse the journalists broadly of that, but I would accuse the population. I would accuse 63 million voters of that. One of the statements that this reminds me of one of the statements in the book that got my attention in regards to possible motives in the Kremlin, and it is that racial divide in the U.S., namely that you mentioned, or I, the two of you mentioned that the Kremlin subsidized, I think it was Marine Le Pen, evidently, in France, evidently just to destabilize a NATO country. Do you think that the Russian effort was all about destabilization then, or do you think that they were more interested in actually electing Trump? Or do you think that was a surprise?
I think they were surprised they succeeded, but I think it was a bit of both. I think initially, in our book Russian Roulette, Mike and I describe how Moscow had been planning for years how to use disinformation and cyber attacks against Western countries to destabilize them and to do so to undermine their elections. I think that was what they were looking to do with the United States at the very beginning of this process. But as they saw Trump become the nominee, and as you know, they came up with the, I think they probably thought it was a long shot that they could also, you know, do more than just destabilize and make things a mess here. They could actually help get Trump elected, and which would help them, you know, because he had been friendly to Putin. He was no fan of NATO and our Western alliances, and they might have had thought they had compromising material on him or not, but certainly he was not Hillary Clinton, who had spoken out against fake elections in Russia and had been giving Putin, when she was Secretary of State, a hard time. So there were a lot of reasons that they would prefer Trump to Hillary Clinton. And I think it was like, well, as long as we're here, we may as well try to help him as well.
You set the tone at the beginning of the book for Russian aggression against the U.S. and against U.S. politics. Interestingly, you are, if I can use the Texan plural, y'all put the MLK assassination by the American secret police into the mouth of the Russians, which I found a little jarring because, you know, what is it? I guess 19 years after the conclusion of Coretta Scott King versus Jowers, it's pretty clear that the U.S. secret police were involved in that. And the reason I bring that up is because I'm interested in the tone that you're trying to set there. You mentioned, for example, Victoria Nuland, but you don't identify Nuland as Dick Cheney's disciple, nor as a member of the National Endowment for Democracy, and clearly an agent as well as just a State Department operative in Ukraine, destabilizing that country.
Our purposes of this book was to talk about what she was doing in context with the Obama administration's overall plan to avert a crisis in Ukraine.
And you would call what she's doing averting a crisis? I mean, she was surely involved in supplying arms to the militias, to Svoboda Right Sector.
The Obama position was not to do that. And it was to, once there were popular protests and Ukrainian demonstrators are being shot down by forces loyal to Yanukovych, if not on his orders, to try to work out with NATO or with European allies and with Russia, basically a stand down in which everybody would take a step back. There'd be elections in 6 months. and it did not necessarily lead to an immediate ouster of Putin-friendly president. And in the course of doing that, she was spied upon by Russian intelligence, and it was, you know, we noted that this was one of the ways they were trying to deal with an information campaign against the West. That's, you know, that's the role that she played in this story, and I think the facts support our presentation of it. Anything that she may have done, you know, previously in her career working for anybody else was not on point.
All right. I don't see, I mean, when I think about Victoria Nuland, I really can't separate her story, her character away from, well, I mean, there's BBC reports on the activity that was going on under her reign, as it were, in Ukraine. And it's pretty, the reason I'm bringing this up is it's pretty clear to me that the Russians would have good reason to be furious at the U.S. and at Nuland and at Obama over the activities that were occurring prior to Yanukovych.
Having spoken to all the senior Obama people who are involved in dealing with Ukraine policy, I am 100% convinced that their goal at the end of 2013, early 2014, after Ukrainians on their own had started protesting against Yanukovych, and after violence had started breaking out, you know, precipitated by the pro-Yanukovych forces, that their goal was to cool things down and try to create stability for Ukraine to find its own role, you know, whether it wanted to be pro, you know, lean towards Russia or lean towards the West, forward in Europe. And I, you know, so, you know, I know there are people out there with other ideas, sometimes even conspiracy theories, but that was the Obama position. That is the deal they negotiated. And this is a really, you know, there's no point in re-debating it now. It's a small piece of our book. And it does go to the fact that even when they were trying to do that, this is what we point out in the book, Putin had a very paranoid approach and believed that they were plotting, that Obama and others were plotting against him. They thought he thought, you know, a couple years earlier when there were spontaneous Russian demonstrations against Putin for fraud and abuse during elections, Putin accused Hillary Clinton of orchestrating these demonstrations.
And you don't find that credible?
That was absurd. It's not credible. Tens of thousands of Russians go to the street after viral videos come out showing ballot stuffing.
Well, no, that's interesting. How can you say it's not credible?
When Putin has been locking up journalists, some journalists are getting killed, and preventing people from running in elections. And so tens of thousands of Russians, you know, take to the streets in an act of tremendous bravery against a state that has already shown its willingness to arrest, if not kill, people. And then he makes it about Hillary Clinton? No, it's not about Hillary Clinton. And anyone who says it is just siding with Putin's own disinformation.
Well, I would call that a smear, David Korn, because I really don't see where you're going with that. I mean, let's look at history. The NED, you would not deny this.
No,
put Yeltsin in power. Yeltsin bombed his own parliament. I mean, there's blood. There's 6,400 dead in the Ukraine conflict.
Go ahead. Excuse me. I've been writing about national security abuses that the United States commits for over 30 years now. I've written books about that. I wrote books about the Iraq War. I've written books about the CIA. But you know what? Sometimes the other guys are bad. And Putin is an autocrat and a thug who has acted terribly when it comes to preserving democracy and rights in his own country. And, you know, when Hillary Clinton calls him out on that, that's a good thing that the American public is doing, the American official is doing. And yeah, I know about Chile and Guatemala and Vietnam and everything else, but it's a good thing when we get someone in the Obama administration to point out there are human rights abuses and affronts to democracy in Russia and elsewhere. And the idea that those tens of thousands of brave Russians who took to the street to protest Putin are somehow being manipulated by Hillary Clinton, I find that insulting to people who are doing far more than you and I do to protect and preserve democracy by putting their bodies on the line in front of a state that routinely makes people disappear.
Well, I agree with just about everything you say, except that I do believe that they were also manipulated, because that has been continuous under the U.S. State Department, with the NED operating in collaboration with the CIA to destabilize Russia and many other countries, as you know. I'm talking with David Korn about the book Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:49. And I've gotten to, we're talking about the background, and I'm trying to I'm trying to make the point that I believe that the Russians have been, well, I wouldn't say driven to their position, but I think that they are reacting to a great deal of skullduggery by the Americans, and they're, and the point I was getting around to make, or the question I wanted to ask you is, don't you think that the skullduggery that the Russians have done in our election is a response to that?
No. No. In our book, we show that Putin has long developed an idea to weaken Western democracies. He does not want democracies challenging him and his autocratic regime. So one way he does that is trying to discredit democracies where he can find them, and tries to create internal disorder and chaos so that they won't be in a stronger position to challenge him. So he supported Le Pen and the far right in French elections. They got suspicious loans from Russian sources. He has used cyber hackers to target Estonia when Estonia wants to assert its own independence from sort of the Russian sphere. So, yeah, I mean, listen, you know, two wrongs, you know, this is a very basic thing. Don't make a right. The United States does have a history of meddling elsewhere, and that's wrong, and we, you know, and hopefully, and we've seen in the past, you know, some mainly Democratic administrations come to terms with what we've done in Chile and Guatemala and other countries around the world. But, you know, Putin is not doing this because, you know, of Americans' bad actions in the past. And I do think if you look at the history of what Obama tried to do with a reset with Russian relations, it's quite clear that his goal was to try to put things on a much better footing with Russia.
And you write that Putin responded with racism, or...
We note that Putin, you know, internally would have meetings with his aides, and they would refer to Obama routinely with the N-word and deride him as feckless and someone who they could, you know, thought they could manipulate. So this is not, you know, they're not doing this out of self-defense. They are doing this because Putin has a pretty ugly view of the world, that there is it's a zero-sum game. And he wants to go back to the to spheres of interest where he gets to control not just what happens in Russia, but in all the countries around Russia. And he doesn't want to be challenged in that move for control, in the move to sort of revive a neo-Russian empire by the United States or anyone else. Why do you think there's been Russian involvement in Brexit? You think he cared that, you know, about the fact that some people in Britain thought that if you know they had too many immigrants because of their involvement in the EU? No, he didn't care about that. He saw this as something just causing divisiveness and weakness in the West, and that's why Russia favored Brexit.
So for your analysis, this is about Great Russia then?
This is what is about Putin.
Russian expansionism.
You know, consolidating his power and engaging in expansionism. Now, you know, a few years ago, we would not have thought it was possible that anyone would do that, you know, in Europe through military means. But that's exactly what he's done in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. But certainly, he is messing around in other countries nearby to increase Russian influence. So it is, you know, a Russian expansionism, which I don't want to be paranoid about in a Cold War sort of way, but it is, I think, his intent to expand Russian influence. And I think that's not a good thing, given that for him, Russian influence is equivalent to Putin's authoritarian rule. And we see now, here, being back home, Trump engaging in ways that are familiar to students of creeping authoritarianism. He certainly wants to be an autocrat. He is attacking the rule of law. He is making common cause with Duterte in the Philippines and with Kim Jong-un, who he praises. And so
he certainly does seem to like the autocrats.
He likes the autocrat, and Putin likes being an autocrat. And he, you know, attacked. You bring it back to our book, Russian Roulette. This was an attack.
Well, let's bring it back to your book.
Donald Trump has gone along with it and has basically denied it happened, providing cover to Putin. And the way I describe this is, imagine there's a guy on a street corner standing in front of a bank, and the bank's being robbed, and the guy's told the bank's being robbed. He can look around and see there are guys with guns and masks in the bank. Yet when people walk by and they say, what's going on in there? The guy says, nothing. Nothing. They go, is it a bank robbery? They go, no, it's not a bank robbery. Nothing's going on.
Could be anything. So, and that is your criticism, as you say, in Chapter 14, that the U.S. press simply hasn't hopped on this story in the way that they should. I'm talking with David Korn. I'm sorry, go ahead and answer that.
No, I was saying, and Trump is out there denying it's happening, and even if he's not in on the actual bank robbery, he's helping the bank robbers get away with the deed.
The book is Russian Roulette. I'm talking with David Korn, co-author with Michael Isikoff, Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War in America and the Election of Donald Trump. And since we're getting towards the top of the hour, I'd like to invite you to comment then on the outcome of this and how it affects what we see in the news today. Again, the opportunity for Trump to select another Supreme Court nominee.
Well, it's a problem. I mean, we have a fellow who's in the White House who I don't believe is committed to protecting the security of the United States, which is his number one job, and now he gets the chance to nominate yet another Supreme Court nominee who may at some point in time have to rule on some of the key issues that could come up in the Trump-Russia investigation. Can Trump pardon himself? Can a president be indicted? If he is subpoenaed by Robert Mueller, can he say no to the subpoena? There are some very important and very big constitutional issues brewing in the Trump-Russian investigation, and they could well reach the Supreme Court, yet a guy who claims this is just a witch hunt and all hoax may be about to appoint a justice who could end up being a deciding vote on one of these matters.
David Korn, winner of the 2012 Polk Award, thank you very much for joining me on KBOO Portland this morning. The book is Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump by Michael Isikoff and David Korn. And I hope that you will stay tuned. We are going to air Cascadia next here on your People Supported radio station, KBOO. David Korn, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You're listening to us on 90.7 FM in Cascadia and other frequencies in Greater Cascadia. And on KBOO.FM and in that manner to all the ships at sea. You've been listening to Press Watch, produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. To hear previous shows, go to kboo.fm/presswatch.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Up next, we have Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers. At 11:30, it's The Film Show. All this KBOO programs are made possible by members just like you. And you can become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor IRANFORM, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The IRANFORM will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
For hours, once again, our world has shifted on its political axis. Anyone paying attention knows that the Supreme Court has changed radically. Justice Kennedy is...